Lots of news to discuss, but first, the parents of slain Jacksonville teen Jordan Davis cried in court this week after Michael Dunn was convicted of first-degree murder in his second trial for killing Davis in a dispute over loud music. Here's Ron Davis after the verdict.
I wanted Jacksonville to be a shining example that you could have a jury made up of mostly white people, white men, and be an example to the rest of the world to stop the discriminatory practices, stop discriminating, stop looking where we have to look at juries and say what the makeup of juries are. All across this nation, every time there's a trial between a victim that is black and someone that shot him that is white, the first thing we look at is what is the makeup of the jury. Is the black victim going to be represented? And hopefully this is a start where we don't have to look at the makeup of the jury anymore. All we can do is put on a case and look at the minds and the souls and the hearts of people, of human beings, not of skin color.
The 47-year-old Dunn now faces life in prison without parole in Davis's death. Right now, we want to know your thoughts about the verdict in the Michael Dunn case. And what are your thoughts about Ron Davis's remarks about how the makeup of the jury drove the national conversation? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Tweet and email the show. Fred Matthews, let's begin with you. The parents of Jordan Davis saying how gratified they are that their son received justice. But there was certainly much controversy and anger that it took a second trial to attain this first-degree conviction for Mr. Dunn. What are your thoughts this morning?
Well, it was certainly a much more focused prosecution. They had the opportunity of hindsight and being able to focus on what was important in the trial. And, of course, there wasn't any opportunity, as many have indicated before, to overcharge and thus make distractions for the jury here. So it was a much easier trial for the prosecution than it was the first time, and, again, more focused. But equally important here is that this jury was a jury of Mr. Dunn's peers. We must not forget that. That's one of the reasons why it was chosen. You get to do that. And it was not Mr. Dunn's responsibility to prove his innocence. It shouldn't have been. But unfortunately, it was the burden politically was upon him and his defense team to prove his innocence. And obviously, he wasn't able to do it.
Dan Scanlon, a big win for State Attorney Angela Corey. She needed one. There's been much scrutiny of the office in the wake of George Zimmerman's acquittal. There's also controversy about an upcoming retrial for a local woman, Marissa Alexander. Angela Corey and her team saying justice has been served.
Well, they certainly did refocus their attack on Mr. Dunn this time, and they did have a lot cleaner, more streamlined defense. And I don't think Mr. Dunn did himself any favors with some of his own comments from the stand. I think he came across as what I've always suspected he was, just a person who has a low tolerance for certain things in life. And when he made the statement, I would have shot 50 or 100 times to eliminate the threat, when realistically no threat had been there, because, again, he came after the three others in the vehicle. I think that may have sealed his doom. The fact also that this was 5 hours of deliberation from a mostly white male jury and only really a handful of days to get through this case, it is a win. And if you drove by the courthouse for the past week, no protesters until the last day, all of those supporting and cheering, it was a much quieter place to be.
Yeah, A.G. Gankarski, a lot less national media attention, too, this time.
Right. It's really something that the first time we saw a lot of national media attention. This time we saw the national media focused on other things. And really, as probably as it should have been, because at the end it was just basically murder in the first trial. It was something where I noticed that the prosecution completely outclassed the defense at every turn. I was very surprised by the Dunn defense, and I thought they would have had a better chance arguing it to second-degree murder, arguing that, in fact, it was overcharged rather than trying to exonerate him. I thought that was curious.
And the number to join the show as we discuss the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable, 549-2937. We want your calls and comments about the biggest news of the week here along the First Coast. Tim Gibbons, certainly as you talk with business leaders in Jacksonville, none of these trials are what local business and civic leaders want splashed out in national publications on national news.
There actually is a sense of, you know, gratitude that this has not become the big national story this time, because it really does hurt the city's image. They want to focus on much more positive things, and things like this, I don't know, seem to be a harking back to the past. So.
Yeah. Would you agree, Fred?
Well, there's no question about that. I mean, you know, you want the Jaguars to stay on the front page. You want to talk about the beer business.
We weren't focusing on bad news.
Yeah. But you want to focus on the pools at the stadium, and you want to focus on the beer business we have booming around town. You don't want this to be the front stage. But, you know, right on the heels of this, we've got the, as we mentioned earlier, we've got the Marissa Alexander trial that's coming up, and now the shifting is back over on the state attorney's office. They're the bad guy in this case. Here they had to prove themselves to be the good guy, but now they're going to turn to be the bad guy. It's going to be a national focus once again. It's going to put our stand your ground law in Florida back up again, so you got to get through that. But hey, you know, we wanted to be a big city, and this is what you get.
This is part of it, yeah.
It is interesting from that reputation of the state attorney's office standpoint, of the idea that, you know, this trial, the Dunn trial, was, you know, on the side of you know, against racism. Mm-hmm. And then Marissa Alexander is like, no, that's on the wrong side. Yeah. It's much more complicated.
I mean, because you're looking at this, yeah, and it puts Florida's laws in the flip focus here. Here you got a gun that went off and shot no one. And on this one,
you're talking Marissa Alexander.
Marissa Alexander. And now you got a gun that went off and shot someone and could have and attempted to shoot some others. You know, the two things don't seem, but the penalty essentially could be the same thing, life for each one of these folks.
Absolutely. It brings to light some of the peculiarities of our system here in Florida. Here's an email from Jessica. Is it true that first-degree murder is a conviction for premeditated murder? The facts of the case seem to point to Mr. Dunn being angry in the midst of a heated argument. Would that not fall under a different charge? Was he overcharged? The law states that premeditation can be a few minutes, a few seconds, correct? Mm-hmm. Dan Scanlon.
Yes. And that's and if the fact that he got angry and did have a confrontation with him would have been just enough time for him to make the decision that he was going to fire the gun and kill. And again, the fact that he fired and then continued to fire as the vehicle went is indication. I've always argued that if you're afraid for your life, you fire a few shots and run. You don't take a stance and continue to fire. Again, don't forget his background. As he proclaimed proudly, he'd been a shooter since he was age 8. He'd been regularly part of a shooting club. He was a trained shooter, and he had a gun in his glove box, registered, ready to go.
When we discussed this on the program yesterday, AG Gankarski, criminal defense attorney Mark O'Mara was here in studio. He, of course, represented George Zimmerman in the Central Florida trial on the shooting of Trayvon Martin. He took quite a few calls from listeners who wonder if these trials will bring the focus back to the underlying issue of gun control. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, obviously, we're going to keep revisiting the issue of gun control every time something like this happens. And, you know, that was really something with the Dunn defense in this case. It seemed like the real case that could have been made was that there was a mental break. There could have been a case made against the premeditation. And, you know, the things that Dan brings up regarding Dunn's long history with guns suggest that perhaps we have to take yet another look at gun control. We'll see what happens in the governor's race. And if Crist is governor, perhaps we're going to get a state-level look at it that we're not getting right now.
The number to join the show with your thoughts and be part of our Friday Media Roundtable, 549-2937. Let's go now to Susan in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Melissa. I just wanted to remind people that in the bigger scheme of things, you know, with the elections coming up, we really have to look to our local leaders, you know, for leadership on this issue. Unfortunately, right now, what I see when I go to, for example, my representative's town halls, Representative DeSantis, we see a real invitation to violence of extremists even at these public meetings. For example, the last one that I went to with Representative DeSantis, if you can believe it, a young man was beaten by two elderly men for wearing a shirt with a picture of Mao Zedong on it. And
a picture of who?
Mao Zedong.
Oh, okay. Okay. And this happened at the meeting? At the public meeting?
This happened at the town hall because, you know, our leaders, for example, Representative DeSantis, you know, they really embolden extremists and gun rights nuts, you know, to really feel emboldened and empowered to use violence against our community. And I think that that's really something that needs to be looked at very closely.
That's Susan in Mandarin. I hadn't heard about that incident. Now, what about her comments? Fred, what do you think?
Well, I mean, these are the side arguments that come to play with this. But the reality of it is that it's not going to change the gun laws or the feeling about carrying guns in this state or anywhere in the South that I can think of.
Well,
I mean, it's just not going to change anything.
Let me ask you about that, because the mothers of Jordan Davis and Trayvon Martin have joined this national group, Moms Demand Action on Gun Sense. And they have likened themselves to the movement that began in the 70s and 80s, MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. When that group of moms got started, they were poo-pooed and dismissed, and they eventually did make quite an impact.
And they
changed laws. They changed hearts and minds.
Well, that's all well and good. But if getting the President Reagan shot by a gunman did not change the mind of his party to support gun laws around this country, and we're still electing largely Republican conservative legislatures throughout the South and now half of two-thirds of the nation who aren't going to support this, there just isn't going to be any change. You've got to change. We've got to agree or movement to change the legislators who put these laws in place that keeps this game going. And they're not going to change. If we're not going to change out the legislature, it's going to stay the same and we'll continue to march.
If things didn't change after Sandy Hook, it's not going to change after pretty much anything. I mean, that was, you look at other countries who've had, you know, Australia's famous, had a school massacre. Basically, the country went, you know, this doesn't work, got rid of guns. That's compressing a bit.
Dan Scanlon.
That said, the grace under pressure that Trayvon Martin's mother and his mother here has shown, and the parents' comments just before the verdict, to no matter which way it comes out, we're happy with this. I think that soothes the waters of the community out there to know that there's no reason to get ticked off if this doesn't come your way. Work like the mothers are doing with grace and pressure behind the scenes and in front of Congress to try to change the laws.
Let's go to Mark on the South Side. Hi, Mark. What are your thoughts? Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to shed a little light on something that Angela Corey said yesterday that I think does great into the fact of Marissa Alexander's trials coming up and our gun culture. Basically, what Angela Corey said is that Michael Dunn, the 60 years that he got, is not for attempted murder. It's because he discharged his weapon and did not hit anyone. That's why he's getting 60 years. It's because he fired his gun and did not hit somebody.
Yeah, you're right. He was convicted on a range of charges in the first trial. Mark, you're absolutely right. Thank you for pointing that out. Rick in Riverside, rather. Rick. Hi, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to maybe clarify something the gentleman on your panel said earlier. He seemed to imply that gun control had not worked in Australia. Have to disagree with that. They haven't had a mass shooting since they banned assault
right
weapons.
And that's what he was, that's exactly what Tim was saying. Okay. Rick, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The other thing I wanted to say was about the general gun culture. Wanted to point out that Sheriff Rutherford had recently encouraged people to carry weapons with them if they're legally allowed to do so, and I really feel that Michael Dunn's trial shows, if anything, that people in, you know, emotional situations would all do things that they might not otherwise have done. If Michael Dunn had to go back to his hotel room to get a gun to settle an argument, I think he would have thought better of it. He'd be free now. His family would be free of the turmoil they've been through. And a young man would be alive. I don't think that you can show anywhere that the availability of guns has reduced murder. Where the gun control laws are strict, the murder rate is lower. And I think where the gun laws are loose, as in Jacksonville and Florida and most of the South, the murder rate is higher.
And that's Rick in Riverside, AG.
Yeah, I'd say there are probably other contributing factors to the murder rates in different regions. I would also say that you really have two competing points of view, the stand your ground approach and, you know, the sort of hunting culture that existed in this country until very recently, you know, versus the idea of state-imposed gun control. One of the issues with, you know, one of the things in favor of people actually carrying weapons, and I don't carry weapons, I'll keep this in mind, but, you know, is that people don't feel safe. People don't feel protected by the JSO. People don't feel secure in their persons. And this is true not just in Jacksonville, but, you know, across the country. And, you know, this is going to be a discussion that's going to continue happening, and there's no easy answer to it. And either way is risk.
We'll keep talking about it on this program, but when it comes to law enforcement, we do need to mention the big story this week out of Atlantic Beach. Authorities charged the police chief there, Michael Classy, with 18 counts of possession of a controlled substance, as well as charges of codeine trafficking, evidence tampering, and possession of drug paraphernalia. The FDLE announcing this, caller of the Atlantic Beach police chief on Tuesday, Dan Scanlon.
He was ordering them, according to the allegation, on computer from countries that were somehow slipping through the net on this, picking them up. And then when apparently he learned of this, he tried to get rid of, and then did get rid of, the laptop computer that had the orders on it. But then we find out that that he had 18 counts, if memory serves.
Yeah.
It's just amazing that a law enforcement person would think they could get away with this, if indeed this is true. But that said, obviously somebody was watching the mails.
Right. Now, Classy could face up to a 100-year prison sentence. This also drew a comment from State Attorney Angela Corey. Tim, she took a moment out of the Michael Dunn murder trial to talk about this very high-profile arrest that took a lot of people out at the beaches, I think, by surprise.
It's hard to wrap your head around it. I mean, the idea of just the sheer quantity of different things. I mean, it's, I don't know, a fan of Hunter Thompson. I kind of picture that scene at the beginning of Fear and Loathing when he's loading everything into the trunk, and it just sounds like this array.
Almost cinematic.
Yeah,
in a way.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's go to Keith in Mandarin. Hi, Keith. What are your thoughts?
Hi. Well, I'm back on the gun control issue, and I believe Chicago has one of the strongest gun control laws in the country, and they also have one of the highest murder rates. Is that not correct?
They do. And depending on your point of view, you could say that the gun control laws are don't work, or that because the surrounding states have loose laws, that's why they can't control the flow of guns into Chicago. It depends on how you look at it, I guess. But you're right about that, Keith. Chuck at the beaches. Go ahead, Chuck.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the Atlantic Beach sheriff.
Yeah, go ahead.
Apparently, he has an issue with drugs, and I'm assuming using them. And the unfortunate thing, and the sympathy that I have for him, is that he has an illness.
Right.
And that illness that he has, I mean, if he has a drug addiction and has some familiarity with it, when he wakes up in the morning, he's going to have that drug, and he's going to do whatever he has to get it. So, you know, I understand he did what he did was wrong, but I think we have rampant addiction from Oxycontin, et cetera, which has turned into heroin addiction. So this is just an example. I mean, you look at Betty Ford, Dukakis's wife, Kitty Dukakis, people who have these issues, and I'm guessing that perhaps some of your people on the panel and some of the people are listening, I can't imagine that they have as rampant as it is, they don't have some familiarity with it. So
no, sure.
We see who it can affect.
Yeah.
And I think we've got to do something about this.
You're right. It does point up the larger issue of these types of substances, addiction to often legally prescribed substances, AG, wrecking lives.
Yeah, and really this is ironic because you've got somebody, officer of the law with Xanax, with codeine, with syringes, all of that, at the same time that all of the Republican forces and, the police chiefs and sheriff's offices of Florida are mitigating against Amendment Number 2, which would be for medical marijuana, basically calling it the Drug Dealers Act. Well, you got to look at your own. You got to look at these police chiefs. You got to look at these opiate addicts. You got to look at these Xanax addicts and basically see that perhaps we need to move our discussion beyond the 20th century drug war and look at it for what it is. Perhaps we need to look at something like medical marijuana as an alternative to these opiates that have proven to be addictive and that have proven to ruin at least one person's life here.
Michelle in Green Cove Springs. Hi, Michelle. What are your thoughts? Good morning.
Hi there. I'm not familiar with the situation in Jack's Beach. I just kind of want to speak about Michael Dunn and gun control. And one of your people that's on your panel right now said something that was really kind of shocking. You know, it's not people using legal guns to commit crime in this market, in this community. It's the illegal guns. My heart goes out to the Dunn family. But the other focus really needs to be in the Jacksonville area about the guns and violence against young black males in our community. I'm terrified. I have to drive around for a living. And I'm terrified when I'm in some of these areas, Murray Hill, Edgewood, 8th Street, where there is known crime. And it's dangerous for anybody to be back there. And to say it's a gun issue or that it's not like they're using guns that they purchased in a legal manner to commit crimes against one another. I mean, there was just a young boy, 14 years old, who was gunned down outside a pool earlier this summer. Nothing. It's like crickets. Nobody is talking about that. Mm-hmm. And I just don't see where putting stricter gun rules on people is going to be helpful at all. Frankly, when my husband and I drive around, we carry a gun in our vehicle. And if I was allowed to do so at work, I would do so. But I'm not. I mean, it really is. There are areas of this community and in this city that are dangerous to be in. And I just wish your panel would kind of remark about that, because I am glad about what happened with Mr. Dunn. I am glad that he's been convicted. What he did was atrocious and outrageous. But there is a time and a place to protect yourself, and particularly in Jacksonville, particularly in some of those areas that I mentioned, where crime is just out of control and nobody is doing or saying anything about it. Nobody is crying for the mother whose 14-year-old was shot outside of that pool in Murray Hill. Nobody is even talking about it. So that's all.
Yeah, and that's Michelle in Green Cove. Thanks, Michelle.
And we have been talking about that 14-year-old and his mother. That mother has chosen so far not to surface to respond to it, but the community has certainly responded to it, and they're very angry at this. But, of course, we heard at the shooting scene, I heard that this was apparently the result of some feud between these kids, and then it's later turned out with the four arrests that apparently they were driving by, saw him, and decided to take matters up a notch. So the other thing, too, is when we used to see police reports, how many guns were stolen from homes? Maybe if people would lock their weapons up so that they could not be casually lifted, stolen, borrowed, or otherwise, a lot of these weapons wouldn't be out on the street getting sold, sold, and resold. You track these guns down to a house burglary 10 years ago, in many cases.
Yeah, and I would also add, Michelle, if you're still listening, I made an entire documentary film about Jacksonville's violence problem and our status as the murder capital of Florida. It's called The 904. You can pick that up online. Now, let's move on. The popular mobile car services Uber and Lyft are facing a crackdown from City Hall this week. Councilman Stephen Joe says he's introducing legislation that would allow the city to impound unregulated vehicles offering rides. Uber and Lyft's ride-sharing models allow people to arrange transportation with a simple swipe of their smartphone. Critics say the drivers aren't screened and permitted properly by the city. AG, this is not the first city that Uber and Lyft have faced this kind of pushback.
No, and we're seeing a trend with this. It seems like Uber and Lyft basically talk past city officials and city officials talk past them, and they don't seem willing to come to a concord. And this isn't just Jacksonville. This is everywhere. And, until they figure out a way to actually do this, they're going to face these issues and really impact their business model.
Well, let's talk. Tim Gibbons, the business case for Uber and Lyft is that it's a new way of doing business. It's cheaper. It's quicker. It's easier.
It's disruptive. It's going to change everything. And that's the problem with all of these, of having used the service and having used cabs in Jacksonville. there's a reason people choose to go with a Lyft or an Uber. That's not good for a cab company. It's not good for a cab driver. And arguably, there's been a setup for decades that create and protect that industry.
Fred Matthews, is the council hypocritical in that most of these representatives claim to be small government conservatives committed to free enterprise? Critics say they're not living out their small government principles by trying to restrict this disruptive new business.
The council is responding to a local constituency. This is what they're doing, what they've always done, and that's respond to local constituency. The cab companies here, we know who they are, have long since they know their council people, and they know what buttons to push. Uber and Lyft are the outsiders bringing in a new business model,
well,
which is correct.
Is a very powerful lobbyist. And
who's the lobbyist? I bet you we know who he is. Probably a powerful guy here in town who's able to get it done.
And
he's the one that's pushing on the other side.
When they got them here, it was very quick. And I love
they
the flip-flop.
They did ramp up quickly.
It did. But I love this quote because it just, to me, shows the flip-flop. I was talking to Councilman Stephen Jost when this came in. And he said, this is back when it first came here. San Francisco has it. Paris, France has it. Some of the most socialist cities that have this application for their consumers. If those guys can figure it out, I think Jacksonville can. At that point, it was free market. We can make this work. Yeah. And now it's free market.
It's about them.
Not so much.
Yeah. Now they're not following the law. Now they're not following the law. The people who drive the cars aren't certified. You're getting in a car that's not insured. And the rubber on the tires on the car could be bad that you're getting into. The painting, it's all being drawn up in a council. Having listened to it, people like Joseph and those are having to listen to this every day. So they're going to take some action here, for better or for worse, against this outside company.
That said, the first time that one of these drivers ends up in a criminal situation or has an accident and suddenly these million-dollar insurance policies don't work and I've not heard of this, it sounds like Uber and Lyft are getting the right background checks done. They have the insurance. I've not heard any national issues with them.
Yeah, a quote from the Lyft spokeswoman Chelsea Wilson says they do rigorous background checks on all their drivers and that new rules specific to their model of ride sharing should be drawn up.
But the first time a driver gets in trouble and it becomes an arrest for some criminal activity and the background check, and we keep on hearing elsewhere across the board, background checks don't always catch that teacher who has a record. Look up in New York City with the teacher that got hired and was taking kids on field trips.
But aren't there taxi drivers who have committed crimes or messed up on the job?
In fact, there's movies.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
I mean, let's face it.
Talking to me?
Yeah. Let's face it. What the taxi guys want, and it is understandable, they want these whoever they are to have a medallion on their car, just like they do, so they can be identified in public. We're coming up on the Florida-Georgia game. We're coming up on the Gator Bowl game that's coming out this season. This is when the taxi business in Jacksonville booms, money flows like it never has been before these next 2 months, and you got to get these Uber guys to the side. You got to get them corralled because they're going to take your money, because guess what? I mean, you've tried it already. So you hit your app and the car comes to your door, all your buddies jump in the limousine.
And off you go.
Does anybody gripe about the pedicabs during the big football games? I've never heard of any gripes.